Welcome back to the program. Winston Churchill, in talking about the former Soviet Union, once described it as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. But perhaps there is a key, he said, and that key is Russian national interest. After reading Adam Leshinsky's new book, Inside Apple, it's arguable that you could say the same thing about that company. It has been a company that for many journalists and business watchers has been a puzzle difficult to solve. Adam Leshinsky may have broken the code. He's a senior editor-at-large for Fortune, where he covers the Silicon Valley and Wall Street. His cover story subjects have included Google, Hewlett-Packard, as well as Apple. And it is my pleasure to welcome Adam Leshinsky to the program to talk about his new book, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. Adam Leshinsky, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. First of all, we should talk about how you were able to get the kind of access that you obviously got to a company that, as you delineate so carefully in the book, is traditionally so secretive.
Well, my access was shoe leather investigative journalism or shoe leather reporting. The primary group of people who were my sources for the book are former Apple employees from all levels of the organization. My perspective being that the most junior people's experiences are as relevant to my task, which was to describe how the company works, as the types of senior level people that journalists would get at most companies if they wanted to do an article or a book about the company.
And as you talk about in the book, this is not a company that has treated journalists very well over the years.
Well, to use non-judgmental language, I would say that this is a company that believes that the one and only one story that it wants to tell is about its products. And so if you come to Apple wanting to do an article that is about anything other than their product, which is what I wanted to do, the answer quite simply would be no. And you're right. Apple expects all people, not just journalists, but all people to do things Apple's way and to serve Apple's interests, as you so interestingly and ably introduced the topic with your comparison to Churchill's observations about Soviet Russia.
It's interesting that one of the core conflicts, it seems, that emerges within the company is between this kind of traditional, old-school, secretive, top-down, big corporate culture and trying to balance that against the kind of entrepreneurial ethos that is the Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and Apple is more of the former, actually, top-down, button-down corporate than it is entrepreneurial, except with Steve Jobs running the show for the last 15 years, he was perhaps the greatest entrepreneur we'll ever witness, and so he made the company into an entrepreneurial powerhouse, almost through the sheer force of his will. But you're right in that Apple, I describe as a series of paradoxes, and this is one of them, this corporate entity that behaves in an entrepreneurial fashion where appropriate.
And yet the Silicon Valley itself, this sort of land of entrepreneurialism, has embraced both Apple and more specifically its products in such a dramatic way.
Well, it's interesting. So first of all, Silicon Valley famously is stronger on engineering than it is on management. And there's been a lot of weak management over the years in the Valley. So that companies that are well managed, you know, Intel comes to mind, rise to the top in part because of their excellent management. But I would suggest to you that the Valley really hasn't embraced Apple's products. The rest of the world embraced Apple's products, and it was really only recently that Silicon Valley caught up to this embrace. And so when I came to the Valley 15 years ago, and for many years after that, it was not at all uncommon to meet people in my professional capacity who had no interaction whatsoever with Apple because they lived in a PC world, which meant dealing with the Windows, Microsoft, and Intel PC architecture, not Apple.
You talk about management, and this is where it gets so interesting, in that the way the company has been run by Steve Jobs is in some ways so antithetical to what we hear about today as contemporary management practices.
Absolutely right. So whereas business schools teach openness and transparency. Apple is opaque and secretive. That includes internally. Business schools teach this notion of general management, that a general manager should be able to run divisions within the company. Steve Jobs hated the idea of general management. Why in the world would you want to take somebody who's good at what they do and expose them to other things when they're already serving the shareholder extremely well doing their thing? And then lastly, there's this notion of you know, openness and sharing and empowerment of people below you that is taught in business schools. And right. Apple is all about micromanaging and top-down decision-making.
The good at what they do aspect comes through in almost every aspect of the story that you tell inside Apple. This sense of people staying in the same jobs a long time and Jobs relentlessly focusing on what it is that people do well.
Yeah, and researching the book was a humbling experience for me, in that in my roles as a journalist, I'm the ultimate multitasker. And it occurred to me that Apple people as a whole are not multitaskers. They are encouraged to focus relentlessly on what it is that they do. And I've likened the average Apple employee to a horse fitted with blinders. You don't look left, you don't look right. You look forward and you charge forward hard.
Of course, that kind of attitude presupposes that there is, as there was, somebody at the top that took care of everything else.
Yes. There's no question. And at the top, and then they would hope, if you want to be hopeful about Apple, the executive team, which is about a 10-person board of, you know, or committee, if you will, but beneath the CEO, is extremely influential in their realms as well. But these are functional realms rather than divisional realms.
And, of course, what it also required is a tremendous degree of trust on the part of all of those people with the blinders on.
Yes and no. This gets to the controversy of to what extent the company will be able to do well without Jobs. They didn't need so much as to trust as to do as they were told. I understand your point in that you would do your task and you have to trust and assume that everyone else is doing theirs. But this is something a culture that Jobs created, where you could assume that everyone was doing what they were supposed to do, not because you trusted them, but because you knew that Steve Jobs would make darn sure that they would.
There's an element of Stockholm syndrome involved as well.
I've heard also, to mix up metaphors with you, a sense of battered spouse syndrome as well.
Yeah.
People speak with love and admiration for their time at Apple and their fond desire for the company to do well, even if they had a very difficult time of it themselves.
This goes to this idea that people on the outside want to be inside Apple and people on the inside want to get out.
Yeah, that is a joke that I heard an employee tell, and there's an image, in part due to Apple's wonderfully whimsical advertising, that Apple is this touchy-feely, glowing, shining organization, and inside it's really none of those things. It's a very demanding, difficult place.
That advertising, to what extent was Jobs aware of the disconnect between the business he was running, the management style he was engaged in, and what he was marketing and selling to the public?
Well, I'm speculating now, but I don't even think that in his mind this would involve cognitive dissonance. I think he would have been aware, and he would have said something to you like, "So what?"
Mm.
You know, I'm not trying to run a social experiment inside the company here. You know, we have our marketing message because we have our marketing message, and don't confuse that with what it takes to produce these wonderful products, which is difficult, really difficult.
As the company grew, and one of the things you talk about is that there were so many, even during Jobs' 14 years there, after he came back, there were so many different eras in the company. Talk about that evolution and the way it did and didn't change during that period.
Sure. So the evolution is a product evolution, and you really can begin and end any sentence when you're talking about Apple about products. And so the first stage was Jobs' effort to strip away everything, but really four products, two desktops and two laptops. And then came the iMac. And then came iTunes and iPod. And it's phenomenal, but everything grew on top of that because they worked well with the Mac, obviously. And then mm-hmm. the iPod Touch and the iPhone, and that had the same look and feel to the user as the Mac does. And then obviously came the iPad. And so what has stayed the same is a sort of cultural identity of focus and discipline and simplicity and features. And what has changed is the size and complexity and wealth of the company. And one very significant change I think they're going through in front of our eyes right now is that Apple was an underdog company for a very long time. It's hard for us to get our minds around this today, mm-hmm. but in 1997, it was a relatively irrelevant company. It still had fans who were, it was beloved among its fan base. But they were a small group and not important from a commercial perspective. Today, it's, you know, by many measures, certainly the most valuable company in the world, and in many ways, the most one of the most important companies in the world. And so this underdog mentality is going to have to change.
The other thing is that the products had a kind of halo effect, as you talk yes. about it, where one product and the marketing of one product would sell other products.
Absolutely, and this is what has, this is part of the, whether it was genius or great good fortune, Apple will typically put a lot of emphasis on advertising only one or two major products at a time. So if, and what has happened is, if especially with the success of its own retail stores, that if it, imagine if it advertises heavily the iPhone. Well, you go into the store to buy an iPhone, and you have to walk by these gorgeous iMacs to buy your iPhone, and there might be a very friendly sales specialist who's going to talk to you about an iMac if you'd like, and maybe sell you a Macintosh, and so on.
One of the things that you come back to again and again is the simplicity of so many aspects of the
yes.
company, and yet none of it is very simple to pull off.
No, but it's this culture of simplicity, and one of my favorite anecdotes from the book, and this works better visually, but I'll try to do it for you anyway, is that this extends to their marketing. They obsess over how to simplify the marketing message, and so when the marketing people go into their office, there's a wall that they have to pass to get to their desks, and three words are written on the wall. It says, simplify, 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 only there are strikes through the first two simplifies.
One of the other aspects of this is that this goes down, this attitude goes to every aspect of the company. I mean, you tell the story about just the packaging and what goes into the boxes for things.
Yes. And so you can think of this, you know, business people are very fond of the expression best practices. Best practices is catch-all lingo in the business world for this is how we should always strive to do things. And simplicity and rejection is a best practice at Apple. And by rejection, I mean it's part of the culture to say no to things. Do we really need to put that feature in, or is it going to slow the user down? Then if the answer is the latter, then the answer is no. Should we sell to that group of people even though they're not the direct customer? And by those people, I mean big business IT departments. Well, then the answer is no, and so on.
The idea that everything that the company does, every product, packaging, marketing, everything is a conscious decision.
Everything is a conscious decision, and that goes down to writing it down and having a timeline for it. And this is one of the secrets, again, of good integration. Even if people aren't talking to each other, the management has drafted a document that explains to those in the know how it will all fit together, and the fact that that things are on a timeline. All of this highly secretive behind-the-scenes work is leading up to a very public piece of work, which we're all familiar with, which is the keynote address, the product launch at the Moscone Center in San Francisco, for example, and many, many months of integrated, coordinated work will lead up to that moment.
And many of the people that have worked on various aspects of these products don't know even what they've been working on.
Correct. And I described that part of the culture is that Apple employees will gather in a cafeteria at Apple to watch on a closed circuit television the company's keynote addresses, that's because this may well be the first time that these employees are seeing the product. That includes, by the way, employees who've worked on the product, because they probably have only seen the feature or piece of the feature that they worked on.
What impact does that have on morale?
I asked people over and over, do you have fun at Apple? And I would get the response, well, Apple people have a sense of mission about the about the product. And I'd say, yeah, but do you have fun? And they'd say, you have a great sense of accomplishment looking around the room in a restaurant and seeing, or a bar, and seeing people using your products. And I eventually got the picture of it. I should stop asking if it's fun. There's a lot of positive morale associated with being on a winning team. And I don't mean to dodge your question. I'm dodging it in the same way that Apple employees dodged mine, leading me to believe that, you know, morale is what it is, and that's just not at the top of Apple's priority list.
But, of course, that kind of environment relies solely on success and being on the winning team, because there is nothing else. And if for any reason a product fails, or there are problems along the way or speed bumps on the road, then it has a lot of potential problems.
Agreed. But here's where I would not exactly disagree or quibble, but challenge you. You know, Apple had its adherents even in the bad times, and there were many of the employees who were around when Jobs returned in 1997 still remembered when he had been there before in the early 1980s. And so I would liken some, not all of these people, to athletes. And athletes, of course, want to win, but some of them are also in it, especially if you think of, and I'm reaching here for a metaphor, but the non-moneyed sports. They're in it for their love of the game. And some contingent of Apple's people would say, well, I want to work on these products at Apple, and if they succeed, great, I'm going to make a lot of money, and if they don't, I still got to work on Apple products.
How do Apple people view the rest of the Valley, the much looser, seedier pants, entrepreneurial culture, the culture that puts products out in beta form?
Well, to the extent that they think about the rest of the Valley, which there are many arguments to say that they don't, they don't have time or the inclination to think about anybody else. But to the extent that they do, they're certainly disdainful of the way the rest of the industry does things. So this whole notion of putting a beta product out for people to try, or letting slip news of a coming product, is so completely antithetical to the Apple way of doing things that they would only be able to shake their heads in disbelief that other companies don't do it the way they do it.
Or even decisions about particular products that are crowdsourced by other companies.
Again, you're right. The typical Apple way is not to ask customers' opinions about what the product should be. Their way is to decide what the product should be and then delight the customer with it.
As Apple has become more than just a hardware company, a product company, as they've gotten more into the entertainment business, have there been concerns about taking their eye off the proverbial ball?
Well, I'm sure they're concerned about taking their eye off the ball, if for no other reason because they've gotten so big, as much as the fact that they're in new industries now. I think there's a lot of good that comes to them for being in different industries, and that they mix in the world far more than they used to mix in the world. So I can't tell you if they're concerned about taking their eye off the ball. There's no obvious evidence to that effect.
They've become almost, moving towards becoming almost content providers.
Well, yes, except that compared with some other companies which have taken far more, you know, declarative steps in that direction, they haven't. So Google is, you know, owning YouTube, commissions a lot of content. Netflix is generating, is actually developing movies.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon is a book publisher, and Apple is doing none of those things yet.
Right. Yet. To what extent do all of these things that we've been talking about, to what extent do all of them continue? Can they continue absent Jobs? What's your sense of that?
I believe that his way of doing things has been imprinted on the culture of the company, and so I think they will attempt to continue doing most, if not all, of these things. And so the big question, the really big question will be, who will play the role of the, you know, sort of, and I say this in the kindest sense, of the idiot savant who makes all the right decisions, as Steve Jobs has had, made almost all the right decisions, or will they have to change their decision-making process, or will it just not work? I think there's, it's a company of so many pockets of excellence that go well beyond the thing that Steve Jobs was directly responsible for. So their manufacturing excellence, for example, is a result of the leadership of the current CEO,
right,
Tim Cook. I think these things will put them in quite good stead. The question I can't answer is if they can continue this otherworldly success that they've had. Common sense suggests that they can't.
And even internally, nature, business, politics, call it what you will, abhors a vacuum. And to the extent that there are vacuums that get created in that decision-making hierarchy,
yeah,
who knows what happens?
You know, that'll be a question of the difference between structure and implementation. The structure is there for there to be no vacuum. The CEO has the powers that that Jobs left him. Now, whether he exercises them in the same way or not will be the question. There's no doubt of is that there'll never be another Steve Jobs, and I don't think that Tim Cook, the current CEO, is embarrassed by the fact that he's not Steve Jobs. No one could be.
What role does money play in all of this? You talk a lot about the sense of money and the use of it within the company in terms of developing these products and marketing the products.
So again, this comes back to Jobs. Jobs had a different kind of relationship with money than most extremely successful people. I think at one level he liked spending it on certain things. At another level, he didn't want to talk about it. He didn't want Apple to be the kind of place where people thought about how much money they could make. It's almost a variant of this advice to young people in their careers, do what you love and the money will follow. That's the product development approach at Apple as well. Let's make products that we want to use, that we think people will like, and we'll figure out the market for it later. Now, having said that, when Apple has made a product or is in the process of making a product, it will spare no expense in making it and marketing it and telling the rest of the world about it, because especially the way Apple takes great risks with its products, and when the products hit, the amount of money they make dwarfs what they possibly could have spent marketing it, and that's their mindset.
You talk about the individual buy-in to the mission of the company. How is that mission defined?
In a word, the mission is, you know, make great products, and it's almost as simple as that. Make products that are better than everybody else's, and that we want to use, and so we assume that customers will want to use them too. That's the mission. I mean, Jobs had more highfalutin descriptions of the mission, which were to be insanely great and to put a dent in the universe. That's a lot of hokum, I think, looking back. But if that served making excellent things that everybody wanted to own, then I think they've succeeded so far.
Adam Leshinsky, his book is Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. Adam, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for such a thorough interview. I appreciate it.
Thank you.